Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore the world that we find on the internet to bring you the greatest music history notes that we can put together. I think that we have ourselves a great little session going this week, but to help me with this show is, of course, my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Hello, loneliness, and good evening, world.
And we have a special guest who is here with us tonight, one of my fellow co-workers, Brian Doherty.
Hello, everybody. How y'all doing?
So, yes, there will be two Brians on the show tonight. That's just how it's going to be, people. You're going to have to get used to it. So, you know, let's just not use names at all. We'll just be like person number one, person number two. But like I said, we do have this week in music history for you. And before we get into that, though, I would say if you like our podcast and you want to go check out some other great podcasts, you can go to lineupmedia.fm. They are the ones who allow us to do the show because they're nice people and I happen to work there. But if you want to go check out lineupmedia.fm, you can find tons of great programming out there. A bunch of different shows that I either produce or I'm a part of in some weird way. A lot of the times my voice is actually the one doing the intro for the shows. So you'll hear that as well. Just go check out whatever you want, whatever, catches your fancy and, you know, we'll, hopefully you'll have a good experience with and you'll want to go and continue to listen to other podcasts. If you want to help out our podcast, though, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner on the right hand side. It takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping and we just get a little bit of money back. It's very, very simple. Won't cost you anything extra. Or if you don't want to go to the website, you can just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It takes you to the exact same place. All right, let's get to this week in music history. And of course, we have August 7th through August 11th because we only do 5 days in our weeks because we're weird like that. So, Jake, get us started.
All right, this one is a little bit in depth. It's a little crunchy to start out with, but to hell with it.
I saw the notes on this. It's a freaking long thing that he's about to go through. So sit back and enjoy.
I'll see if I can preface it as I go. So 1925, Matilda Genevieve Scaduto.
Scaduto.
Scaduto, great name. Is born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She would later earn the nickname or be given the nickname from her husband, Felice. Her husband, of course, is Diodorius. Hang on. I'm going to get it. French, not good with. Boudelo. There we go. Diodorius Boudelo Bryant. That's the easy one.
Yeah.
Yes. So Felice.
I'm looking at it too. It's a messed up name.
Right. So Felice and Boudelo Bryant were a power writing couple who we talked last week.
Yeah.
About the bands behind the bands.
Yes.
Right. The Wrecking Crew, the Funk Brothers.
Okay. Yes.
Well, this is the Wrecking Crew of writers in country music.
No.
Yes, the Bryants. I'm telling you. Just wait till you get to it, Brian.
Okay, go through it. We're not even past the second sentence yet.
I know. I'm so excited. So the couple met when Bodie was working with Hank Perry and his Radio Cowboys. He was both a manager and a band member, and he booked a show at the Sherwood Hotel in Milwaukee, where a young 19-year-old Matilda, or Felice, was working. She had gotten the job as an elevator operator by having a previous working relationship with the hotel's management.
Yes.
When she was 17, she started writing music, singing, and booking, managing, producing the entire USO shows at the hotel.
Wow.
Right? In 1943, 17 years old. So they met in the elevator, and Felice said that she instantly recognized Booty's face.
Booty.
Yes, because she had seen it in a dream when she was 8 years old. Later, that experience was written into a song by the Everly Brothers known as All I Have to Do Is Dream.
Yeah.
So there you go. 2 days after meeting in that elevator, the couple eloped. And the first few years were a little bit rough. But by the third year after tying the knot, they sold their first song, which was Country Boy, to Little Jimmy Dickens. And it hit number 7.
Yes.
In the country Billboard.
Yeah, yeah,
charts.
I remember that song.
Yeah. Okay, so once Nashville smells a hit, they don't stop knocking on doors.
Yes.
So in the first 3 years of being married, they had written 80 songs.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this like giant stack of music to just sell to people in Nashville.
Yes.
So eventually they moved to Nashville simply to save on postage because they were sending out so many songs to people. About somewhere in the late 50s, right? So this is 1948 when they sold their first song.
Okay.
In the late 50s, they started like selling music to pop groups, first to the Everly Brothers, and they had their first number one hit with Bye Bye Love, which was written by the Bryans. There you go. And the hits didn't stop, as we'll get to in a moment. Not even when Booty died in 1987. Felice kept writing music right until she passed in 2003. In fact, this is the best. This is the best part of the entire story. They were so talented that they didn't even have to put pencil to paper to get a hit. When Fred Foster, a producer for Monument Records, came to drop off a check for a song that was recorded by Leona Douglas. By the way, Leona Douglas, first black woman to hit a number one country song on Billboard charts.
Nice.
So love you, Fiona, Leona. But anyway, he stopped by to drop off a check and then gave Kris Kristofferson a call later to talk about how cute the secretary was that was working for the Bryans, right? What was the name of the secretary? None other than Bobby McGee. So there you go. Kris Kristofferson wrote Me and Bobby McGee just from hearing the name of the secretary that worked for the Bryans.
Wow.
So just a very short list of the songs that they've written. Right. So and these are like all these are the thing is that the songs that they wrote aren't just like songs that were popular and became hits. They're like the most iconic songs from the bands that bought them.
Yes.
Right. So we got Country Boy, Bye Bye Love, Wake Up Little Susie, All I Have to Do is Dream, Love Hurts, who Buddy Holly later did.
Yeah.
Raining in My Heart, Sleepless Nights, Rocky Top, which was like a gigantic hit in the 80s. She Wears My Ring, You're Welcome, Dale Rawson. Yeah, that's going to, one of our listeners is really going to be happy I said that. Anyhow, and the very strangely boastful song, which I had never heard of before, You're the Reason God Made Oklahoma.
I know that one.
You know that one.
Yeah, I've heard it before. I can't place it, but I definitely have heard it because I thought that's a weird lyric.
Yeah, it really is. So anyway, that's
like, why Oklahoma?
I don't know. Because God didn't make Nebraska, I guess. There's no trees in Nebraska, or weren't.
So that's still pretty amazing. And I'm sure the list of songs like just continues.
Like literally every country artist has done one of their songs at some point.
It's funny.
I just got tired of typing, so I didn't type them all out.
But it is funny that I look at this. The first three stats that we have are like prolific songwriters.
Yeah.
So, but that's great. As far as Felice Bryant, that's great. I love it. Not to mention she hails from Milwaukee. So I always like Milwaukee. It's a good town.
Mm-hmm.
But let's move on to 1954. Like I said, prolific writer. Johnny Cash married Vivian Liberto in St. Anne's Catholic Church in Memphis. Cash had plans of becoming a Memphis appliance salesman, but he instead formed a band with Luther Perkins and Marshall Grant and signed to Sun Records a year later. So he spent a year trying to like figure out what he was going to do in music. And then, of course, everybody's seen the movie after that. And which I kind of felt bad because they really portrayed Vivian in kind of a bad way in that movie. Like they made her seem like really just sort of overly emotional and like desperate for attention.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know. I thought they kind of mistreated her.
Right.
In that
because
movie.
It was so obvious that, you know, Johnny Cash was going to become the icon that he did. Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, it's not that. It's just that, you know, they didn't really portray her right. One of Johnny's daughters, like with Vivian, like came out afterwards and was just like, the movie's great, except they really misportrayed her. It's like she actually was a pretty supportive wife. It's just that she wanted her husband at home more. It's like, so there was that. Did you see that movie, Brian? No, you didn't.
Walk the Line.
Oh, yeah. Walk the Line. Yeah.
Did you know that all the music in there was actually produced by Johnny's kid?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So Johnny's son actually like got them together and walked the two actors and stuff through on like how to record everything and like how to actually sound like them. It was pretty impressive.
Didn't they record some of it on vintage equipment?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a bunch of places down in Nashville that's what they do. They record everything on vintage equipment and then transfer it into, like, Pro Tools or something. So, yeah. But there's there's some places like, I think, Third Man, where you can actually go and record directly onto vinyl. Like, they will actually cut a record of you recording onto vinyl, like, straight, which is pretty impressive. Yeah. A friend of mine actually just went there over the weekend, and he was telling me all about it, so...
Can I chime in real quick? There's
a
place, this is not an endorsement for that place, but there's a place called Welcome to 1979 Studios in Nashville. Great analog recording facilities. It's owned by a guy named Chris. Won't say his last name, but it's a good place.
Why wouldn't you give the last name if he owns
Chris
it?
Chris Mara, I believe, is his name.
Well, there you go. If you're going to do some recording and you want to use vintage equipment, go to?
Welcome to 1979.
There you go. That's perfect. That's a great name for a studio, too.
Yeah. So here we go. 1957. Paul Anka makes his
another prolific writer.
Television debut. No, seriously, though. So not yet the Beatles.
I know you're skipping over Paul Anka, but seriously, Paul Anka's amazing.
I knew you were going to go off on this.
All right. Paul Anka had some amazing hits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his song Calendar Girls. I was looking even in our list, and he popped up a couple of times for different things because he had, like, his first number one hit. You know, it's like all sorts of stuff. But Paul Anka was awesome.
Okay. Well, while Paul Anka is breaking through the industry and becoming...
I'm wrong. I just said the wrong song. I said Calendar Girls.
Yes, you did.
I didn't mean that. That's Neil Sedaka.
Okay. But I don't know the difference.
Whatever. Never mind.
I'm just saying I don't.
I understand that.
Yes.
But Neil Sedaka was the one who wrote Calendar Girls. I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, while.
Go ahead. Move on to your next
one. While Paul Anka is not writing Calendar Girls, not the Beatles, still adolescent, Paul McCartney and John Lennon were playing their first show at the Cavern Club.
Yeah.
Okay. So, just so you know, Paul McCartney was not there for it.
Yeah, he wasn't there. He was. He was gone for the summer
at camp.
At camp. At Boy Scouts.
Yes.
He was a Boy Scout, which just cracks me up for some reason.
I don't think they call them Boy Scouts in the UK.
But
it was
the Boy Scout summer camp.
Oh, if
like,
you
that's,
say okay.
I,
sure.
I saw. I was reading up on that little fact, and it was like, yeah, he was gone at the Boy Scout summer camp.
All right. Well. So Quarrymen go to play their first show at the Cavern Club. And in a conversation with the club manager, Alan Seitner, the Quarrymen are strictly told that rock and roll is not Cavern Club material.
Yeah,
however,
because the Cavern Club was a jazz club.
Yes, they were.
And skiffle was tolerated. And they were primarily a skiffle band.
All right, then. Thank you.
Skiffle, if you don't know what skiffle is kind of like this weird mix of like rockabilly and... Yeah, it's kind of like rockabilly and bluegrass.
Okay.
Which is why it was tolerated by a lot of stuff, but they called it skiffle over
in
the UK.
So did the Quarrymen have, I mean, they didn't have a banjo player, did they?
No. It used like country instruments and stuff, but it was that same sort of fast picking style.
Okay, chicken picking.
Yeah. Okay. It was that kind of stuff, but it was British people.
But without a dulcimer, without a dobro.
Okay. Yes.
Interesting. All right. Anyhow, so halfway through the set of Skiffle, John Lennon thinks to himself, this could be the only opportunity I have to play in front of a rock and roll crowd because if Paul was here, the rest of the band wouldn't follow me. But since he's not here, I might be able to get away with it. So he breaks into Don't Be Cruel. And it turned out that Alan was right and the crowd really didn't like it, but they let him finish the show anyway.
Yes. And then they come up to him later on and he told him something like... you know, cut it with the rock or something like that. Cut it with the rock and roll. But yeah, if you ever get a chance though, like skiffle music just cracks me up, like on just kind of how it's set up. And if you talk for a second, I'll actually play some.
Okay. So I'm not familiar. Are you a skiffle fan? Red Brian? Roja Brian? No,
nothing Rouge. About it, but I'm willing to learn.
All right. What about bluegrass?
Love bluegrass.
All right.
Here we go. The first one that pops up, Skiffle.
I've gambled up in Washington. I gambled down in Maine. I'm going down into Georgia. Gonna knock down my last game. I'm a gambling man. I'm a gambling man. I've been in Washington many more weeks than three. When I fell in love with a pretty little girl and she fell in love with me. I'm a gambling man, I'm a gambling man. I'm a gambling man, 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 a gambling man, 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 a gambling man, 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 a gambling man. I'm a gambling man, 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 a gambling man, 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 a gambling man, 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 a gambling man.
Something tells me he's a gambling man.
This kind of reminds me of the first time I heard Psycho Billy. I had no idea what to make of it.
So yeah, there's more stuff like that, but it's that real fast sort of finger style and country-esque, but British.
All right, then.
So there you go. You've now learned something new.
Why don't you hit us with 1973, Croc?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let me get back to my notes here. Let's see. 1973. A momentous day in music film history. Jesus Christ Superstar, the movie, is released in theaters. So, okay, so I've seen Jesus Christ Superstar, and of course I've seen the other Christian-based musical, Godspell.
Godspell, yes.
Godspell is still my favorite.
Okay.
But Jesus Christ Superstar had the better singers.
Yes, it did.
And like the dude who played Jesus, who obviously like had a really good voice and everything, I thought was super cool. Not to mention he definitely had that Jesus-esque like look to him, so which was nice. But the guy who played Judas just had like the most killer voice in the entire film, and that's what I loved. Except for the fact that I thought it was funny that they made Judas have the better voice than Jesus. It's like, why? Why give the bad guy, like, the good voice?
Well, if I remember correctly, he was, Carl Anderson is the gentleman.
Yes.
Played Judas Iscariot. And I think he was the only member from the original cast. So he was the only actual Broadway guy.
Oh, okay.
That was there, and everyone else.
I know the guy who played Jesus went on to play him on the on Broadway and like a couple of other places too, but he played him for a good long while, as far as I know. Even up until like the 90s and early 2000s, like he was still playing Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar. You ever seen that one, Brian?
Yes, I've seen Jesus Christ Superstar.
So you know what I'm talking about, though, as far as, like, Judas. The guy who played Judas was just, like, a killer singer.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Just amazing power vocals. Always reminded me of my dad, actually. You don't know my dad. Jake and I, actually, we grew up together, so we've known each other since we were six. But, like, my dad has, like, really great, like, rock vocals, and he actually does listen to this show. So, there you go. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Mr. Croc. How are you?
My parents should be getting back from New Orleans sometime soon, if not today, I believe, actually. I went down to visit some family and stuff because somebody was having birthdays. And knowing my dad, he's going to actually pay somebody to play some Louis Armstrong or something out on the streets, because my dad likes to do that kind of stuff, too. My dad likes all the music down there.
Of course.
I just like the food.
All right, well, I had a guy. I went down there, and a guy on the street, like to the French Quarter, and the guy started playing some song that sort of referenced St. Louis when he asked me where I was from, and then improvised something about a lady that was standing next to me, and just kept singing about her wavy hair and the single highlight, and she had like one highlight in her hair. I don't know. It was.
I do have to say, though, completely non-music related.
Yes.
You ever go to New Orleans, you got to go to Café du Monde, get yourself some coffee, get yourself some beignets, and just sit there, because that's like the highlight of New Orleans.
Speaking of beignets.
Yes, go ahead. Fine, we can go on a food sidetrack.
So the Texas State Fair.
Yes.
Right, is famous for, it's just debauchery when it comes to food. Right, that's where you get like your deep fried Twinkies first showed up and all this stuff, right?
Yes.
So they have an item on the menu now that's called smooth fat.
Oh, good all God. Right?
It is not just beignets. It is three chocolate beignets, skewered, battered, covered in sugar, and then chocolate sauce and caramel.
What? Good God.
Right, because, hey, when you have the opportunity.
I will tell you this, though.
Yes.
You want to know who the kings are of frying stuff? the Scottish.
Okay.
No idea why, but they were just like, hey, we got batter. Let's fry stuff.
Because anything is an improvement on haggis bread. That's why. That's why.
So they were the ones who, like, if you ever heard of the deep fried Mars bar.
Yes.
They were the ones that came up with that.
Okay.
In Scotland. And that's like a big deal to them, is the deep fried Mars bar.
Their Mars bar does not have almonds in it. Just so you know.
Did not know that.
Yeah,
interesting
fact. It's basically a Milky Way.
Okay.
But it's called, anyway, when they brought it to the U.S. and used the Mars bar's name, they made a different candy bar. Just let it sink in. All okay. right.
You make a fine Scotsman, though, even though, you're Irish.
I'm Irish. Come on.
I'm
don't
just
confuse
saying.
The two.
I would never confuse the two. It's like, I know my differences. I can spot most of the Scottish tartans, and I know the Irish didn't do that. So, but I'm just saying, like, if you were to go there, you could pass us as a Scotsman.
Take that as an honor.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's Scots-Irish anyway. I mean, it's like it's the whole... They're all genetically related anyway, so what's the big deal?
There is no segue back into the show. We're four rabbit holes in, so let's just
1981! Let's see here. The film based on the magazine Heavy Metal called Heavy Metal is released.
Yes.
What's that? What's the song? One Step Ticket to Midnight called it Heavy Metal.
Yeah. But I think that Heavy Metal is the first completely fan service film that was ever released in U.S. theaters.
I'll give you that much,
because
yeah.
Because unless you read the magazine and knew the storylines, it's incomprehensible to anyone that's not familiar with them. Also, it's very disjointed because they had several different animation houses do the animation at one time to kind of expedite the process, because otherwise it would be like a four-year endeavor to get one studio to animate it. So some of it's rotoscoped and animation, some of it's limited animation, some of it's Disney style animation. So
yeah,
it's really weird to watch the movie. However, the soundtrack probably has overcome. It's been in print more or less since the movie's been released.
Yes,
while the movie has not been in print that long.
That is true.
Bands that are on there, like Devo, Blue Oyster Cult, Cheap Trick, Nazareth, underrated band, Grand Funk, and of course Black Sabbath.
It's actually funny. It's like that's the second Nazareth reference I've gotten tonight.
Really?
Just tonight. Because I was watching a TV show and somebody was like, when I die, when you die, what song do you want played at your funeral? And she's like, I don't want a Led Zeppelin cover band. She's like, get me Nazareth.
All right.
I was like, okay.
But here's what I didn't know before reading up on this, is that most of the soundtrack, almost all of it, is either original recordings or re-recordings done for the film, or in the case of Black Sabbath, Mob Rules, an alternate take that was not released anywhere else. So, if you buy the soundtrack, you're getting that's the only place those were released. They weren't like an alternate single that was released in Australia or anything.
Interesting. I like that. All right, let's move on. 1982. Let's see. Dexy's Midnight Runners were at number one on the UK singles chart with Come On Eileen, their second and last number one. It was the best-selling single of 1982, and the song won Best British Single at the 1983 Brit Awards, which is basically like the Grammys.
Yeah.
Well, I have an interesting non-music-related fact. It's my aunt's favorite song, and you know what her name is?
Eileen.
Eileen.
That makes sense.
Yep.
I've known a couple of women named Eileen. I always thought that was an interesting name. But I always liked the song Come On Eileen, because it's just a fun little song, you know, and it's like it's got good little time changes and stuff. You know, it's like... It's a very well put together song. Now, the band, however, Dexy's Midnight Runners, completely messed up.
Okay.
So, they were straight edge. No drinking, no drugs, and all that kind of stuff.
In 1982, they were straight edge.
Yeah.
Okay. Didn't know that existed then.
It might not have, but they didn't do drugs. They didn't do alcohol. Okay. They didn't do any of that kind of stuff. But they also, they would get up every morning and, run together. They all had a workout regime, and it was because of the lead singer, I guess Dexy, thought that this band could last forever, you know, if they were all unified in their goal. Like, it just, he had this weird mindset about how to put together a band.
It sounds very like Japanese corporate structure.
I could see that.
Anyway.
So, you know, but it's just an interesting band. If you get a chance, check out more of their, like, information about them, because they definitely weren't a normal band, but Come On Eileen is a really good song.
Yes.
So, what do we got next?
All right. 9 years later, 1991, Paul Simon plays a free concert in Central Park, which is turned into the live album Paul Simon's Concert in the Park. Jeez. And Brian brought it up earlier that this is like the same as the Simon and Garfunkel album.
Right. It should not be confused with Simon and Garfunkel, The Concert in Central Park, I believe.
Okay.
Which came out in 1982.
All right. Is that a good album?
It is. Their rendition of Yumi and Julio down by the schoolyard live in the park was wonderful. Yeah, I got no complaints.
All right.
Yeah. I always like that song, too.
It is a good song. I always think of the Me First and the Gimme Gimme's version.
That is true. That is true. I do think of that version whenever I hear that song. So,
right. I mean, because it's like a minute and 47 seconds long. As opposed to the Simon and Garfunkel, which is, I think, like 4.5 minutes.
So let's jump ahead now to another Central Park concert in 1997 when Garth Brooks played to the largest crowd ever at New York Central Park. Estimated over 1 million people attended the concert, with an additional 14.6 million people viewing live on HBO. Country act in New York.
Yes.
Tearing it up.
I don't even know how you organize an event that big.
You just, it's open. You mm-hmm. set up the stage and then you kind of like wall off a certain area and like.
But you need bathrooms and like some kind of security.
No, they just kind of stop after a certain level. You know, I mean, I'm sure at that concert at least 30 people died and, you know, there were probably a couple hundred kids conceived, but that's beside the point. Just saying. When that man sings the dance, it hits you right in the heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you say so.
That's a great song. I don't care.
I really do like When the Thunder Rolls. It's kind of a guilty pleasure.
What about Standing Beside the Fire?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's not a bad track. It really
is. See, that's the thing. Is that like people like to kind of harp on Garth Brooks and be like, oh, you know, it's Garth Brooks. Ha ha ha. Blah, blah, blah. But in reality, the man wrote some really good songs. Like I said, The Dance is honestly just one of the greatest country songs ever written. It really is.
Man, I don't know if I can go with that. I can't. All right. All of Garth Brooks is tainted because I can't forgive him for Chris Gaines.
Oh.
Because, like, okay, Garth Brooks is so weird. He's like an alien who's acting like he thinks human beings act. Have you ever seen his YouTube channel?
No, I have not.
Oh, he does these blogs that are just like.
You want to know the other thing, though, that I know about Garth Brooks? He used to work at Walmart. And the only reason why I know that is because when we were doing training,
mm-hmm.
we had to watch all of these videos like they do for a lot of, you know, the different things that you got to do. And Garth Brooks was in like a couple of them. And he was all like, hi, I'm Garth Brooks. I used to work at Walmart just like you.
Could you find that video?
It's possible somebody stole one and posted it on YouTube, but it just cracked me up because he's there and he's like in the blue vest and he's got his hat and everything. And he's like, hey, maybe when I give up this whole music thing, I can go back to being a Walmart greeter. And it's just like, oh, Lord, Garth.
That says it all right there. You don't even know, but you touched on it. Garth Brooks, working at Walmart. A 20-something greeter?
No, well, I mean, like, he wasn't a greeter when he was doing it, but he did something else. But he was just saying when he gets old, he could go and he could go back to Walmart and be a greeter.
I didn't know you came from a retail background, Brian. That's pretty cool. I do too.
It's just with Walmart. Jake comes from a Mexican restaurant. / barbecue.
Okay.
/ awesomeness.
I don't know why this is important right now.
I'm just saying, if you're bringing up retail background, I'm bringing up your food background.
I didn't bring it.
I know. I was just okay. I was just passing it off. I was just, you know, oh, okay, here, I'm going to pass it off to this now. So what was your retail background?
Target.
See, my wife worked at Target, so.
Have just, no comment about Target. We'll move on.
Just all right, here we go. 2002, then. Claude Coleman Jr., the drummer for Ween, breaks his back and pelvis in a car accident. Later, Ween plays several benefit concerts to pay for Claude's medical bills. And later in that December, he returns to the band and plays his first live show back. Mm. So, good on Claude Coleman. Glad you're still with us. I've always liked Ween, even though most people confuse them with Weezer.
No, I actually, you know who I was confusing them with?
What?
Weedus.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
Because I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. That's great. We all three of us got together with that song. Have you ever listened to the rest of their album? It really sucks. That's the only good song on the album. All right, let's move on. August 8th. Let's see. I guess I'll do this one. 1941, Les Brown records Joltin' Joe DiMaggio. And you know what? I think that's a good song.
I do too. It could be like the only good song written about a person that has the person's name in it.
I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of like songs about people like with their names actually in it. But if I remember correctly, it's a song. I mean, it's about Joe DiMaggio, obviously.
Right, right.
But it's legitimately like a baseball song about him.
Yes. Yes.
It's not just like a random reference to somebody else. Like it's a legitimate song about Joe DiMaggio. It's like a folk song about a folk hero, you know?
Well, it's
Eddie Pepitone.
Right.
No, that's an old joke going back.
Yeah, but I mean, think of like even like Warren Zevon. He did that Boom Boom Mancini song,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of ham-fisted throwing Boom Boom Mancini's name in the chorus.
Yes.
But somehow Joltin' Joe DiMaggio pulls it off. It's in that weird, like, post-ragtime era, 1940s, kind of Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, yeah.
Style, yeah.
I would like to point out, though, that one of my other favorite songs that was written about a person was written in the last few years, and that was Mark Knopfler's Boom Like That, which was about Ray Kroc of McDonald's.
Yeah, but it doesn't have Ray Kroc's name in the chorus.
No, but it goes, my name is Kroc, that's Kroc with a K.
Yeah, yeah. It's about like Crockett.
It's funny because it's that song's so ingrained into me now. Whenever somebody says, like, you know, going to California, and I'm like, oh, where are you going? It's like, oh, I'm going to San Bernardino. Go to San Bernardino, ring a ding ding. Yeah, milkshake mixers. That's my thing now.
Anyhow, 1953, Les Paul and Mary Ford hit number one with Vaya con Dios. May God be with you.
Now, here we go. Here is a music power couple. All right. They wrote a ton of songs together.
Yes.
Les Paul, of course, doing so many great things, not just like with you know, guitar stuff, but recording equipment, like just all over the place. The man was a complete and total genius. But the thing that I loved is that he was also a phenomenal guitar player. And then teamed up with Mary Ford, who just had a voice like butter.
Mm-hmm.
They made some fantastic songs together.
Yeah, and in our pre-show discussion, Brian, you brought up that he's credited with inventing multi-track recording, right?
Yes.
Although, like, maybe he's not necessarily the first person did it?
Well, Brian mentioned something that...
Some people were working on it, but he was the one that did it, like, the best.
Okay.
So, he was just the one that made it to what it was as far as, like, the rest of the recording industry. He set the standard, and then that's what everybody else did. And actually, there's a great video of him on YouTube with Mary recording multi-tracks live on TV. And he's just like, you know, it's like, okay, it's like, first, you know, we'll record this, then we'll record this. He's like, and then Mary will record this part and this part and this part. And they're like, doesn't that get confusing keeping that all in your head? And they're just like, oh, yeah, it's really hard for us. And I was just like sitting there thinking like, no, it's not hard for you. It's like, you know exactly what it is. You can hear everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
It's like, she knows. She's a talented singer. She knows how to do multi-part harmonies and everything and like in layer. So it's like the only thing that they would have to deal with would be like the rhythm of actually recording it. It's like, you know, so you have to know precisely when to shut off.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're singing with yourself, it is a lot easier. Because you know, well, I sang it this long. You know, I did this part in this fast. It's like you can do the same like vocal rhythm every single time, even if you're doing a harmony part or a melody part. So there you go. I'm actually a huge fan of Les Paul and Mary Ford. I think that, honestly, just they came up with some of the best songs of the era. And I love everything they did. I actually spent like a couple weeks ago just on YouTube just going down the rabbit hole of Les Paul and Mary Ford songs. So,
you know, that was kind of, I guess, the impression of a lot of producers at the time with multi-track recording, that it was just like going to be too difficult to keep track of everything and to cut the process into, you know, so many different pieces. But I mean, like if a conductor can manage to think of all the parts of, you know, an orchestra, and they play those the same way every time in the same tempo, with the same intensity. It's like well within the capabilities. I mean, obviously now, but...
Yeah. But, I mean, at the time, though, it was revolutionary technology. Completely changed the game. And it later on, I mean, because you got to imagine, before that, before multi-tracking was really a thing, everything was recorded just completely live. And you'd have the bands practice and practice and practice, or you'd have session musicians who just knew their stuff come in, put the music down in front of them, play it until they're done. And then like, that's it. That was your recording. Like, so then after that though, you could really get into manipulating the audio to create a sound that you couldn't easily duplicate. And it just kept growing and growing and growing from there. But yeah, I like that.
Well, here we go. 1960, Ray Peterson is about to debut Tell Laura I Love Her in England.
Yes.
And Decca Records has the contract to release it, but they get second thoughts. And they decide at the last minute that they're not going to release it, even after 20,000 or so copies had been pressed. So to break the contract, they had to destroy all those copies, and they did after paying for them. However, somewhat ironically, later in that year, Welsh singer. Oh, hang on. No, we're going to rewind this for a second because I forgot the best part. So Decca Records put out a statement after, like a public statement, because the story caught in the news.
Yes.
About why they had gotten second thoughts about the song, Tell Laura I Love Her. Now, it's a song about a stock car racer that dies while racing. And his last words are to the woman he loves, Laura. Tell her I love her. Tell her this and this and that. Right.
Yes.
They decided that the dark sensibility of the song was too much. And they said, quote, that the song was too tasteless and vulgar for English sensibility. Now, if you listen to the song, I have no idea where the vulgar comes from. Right? You might be able to argue that stock car racing is somehow tasteless. I don't know.
You can't have a song about death. All right, everybody, we're going to do Waltzing Matilda.
Right. So anyway, later in that year, Welsh singer Ricky Valance decides to buy or lease the rights to release the song and record it himself. And he does, and it hit number one in the U.S., or in the U.K., only hit number seven in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go, Decca Records. You did not make the right call there, so obviously. Weird, it was exactly what English sensibilities wanted, because everyone wanted to listen to it.
Weird music side note. The only reason why I know about the song Tell Laura I Love Her is because of the movie High Fidelity.
Yes.
Based off of the British author book, High Fidelity, in which they are listing the top five songs for Laura's dad's funeral.
Yes.
And Jack Black says, tell Laura that I love her. It would bring down the house.
Just saying.
<It's> like, Laura's mom could sing it. Oh, goodness gracious me. That's a good little fact right there. I like that one. Tell Laura I love her. 1969, the photo shoot for Abbey Road happens.
Classic now, photo. I don't believe it was called Abbey Road Studios at the time, was it? It was EMI Recording, correct?
Well, it was the studio at Abbey Road, and so it was colloquially known as Abbey Road Studio. So, or the Abbey Road Studio. So I've been there. So a couple of years ago, my wife and I, we ended up traveling to Europe. We went to London and we went to Paris. While we were in London, though, we ended up going to Abbey Road. And if you go there, there's a lot of people there, always, because there's just a crap ton of people who like to go there and get their photo taken. They've actually got a little spot set up, like, where you can go and, like, take a photo in the exact spot where, like, the camera was and stuff and there. So here's the funny part. The craziness of the photo isn't necessarily that they're, you know, it's the four of them walking across and all of that. They're, it's like, you know, I know the conspiracy theories and stuff out there about Paul, like, not wearing shoes. The weird thing isn't just them taking the photo. The weird thing is the fact that there are, like, no other cars actually driving on that street at that time, because that is a busy frickin' road. I swear to God, like, they've got to have, like, 30 people dying on that road every year, like, just in that one spot. Because those cars, they fly around the corner. You can't see anything coming around the corner. Like, they just fly around that corner, and then, like, boom. This is where everybody walks across at. But I actually thought it was a cool little place either way, just because it was fun to see. And then right next to it is actually where the studio is. Like, it's just, like, less than 100 feet down the road. And, like, they've got it all, like, walled off. And there's a fence. You can kind of see through to the front door, because people go up there and they take photos of the front door and everything. But it's still a fully functioning studio. People are still recording there. Yeah, and so you like look over there and there's just, like, you know, vans and stuff, trucks parked in there, like, where, you know, these bands have their equipment and they unload stuff, you know, to go record. And I don't know who was recording at the time, but there was somebody who was there setting up something huge. So I do remember that. But I got a bunch of great photos of the area and all of that. But yes, if you were into the conspiracy theory things, that photo is a great piece of evidence for the Paul already being dead conspiracy.
Which I have never understood. Because, like, okay, so what? They had Paul go out and pose without wearing shoes and then killed him?
No, Paul was already dead at that time.
So, what, they had a body double stand in shoeless and then...
No.
They airbrushed his head on?
If you let me talk, I will tell you. What it is that Paul died.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot how. They said he died, but he died. And they replaced him with a look-alike and a sound-alike. Mm-hmm. And then he was the one who, like, basically is still Paul McCartney to this day.
A look-alike, a sound-alike, and a fuck-alike, apparently, because his wife has just decided to keep... stay married to him? What? This is the most ridiculous. Come on.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a fun little thing. And these people are dead serious. Like, they believe it's this guy, this other guy. Like, they have his name and everything. And they're always showing photos of, like, here's Paul McCartney at 23. Here's Paul McCartney supposedly at 33. It's like... Look, the cheeks are different. The nose is different. The eyebrows are different. Blah. It's like, you guys, like, I'm sorry. I can tell. I can tell voices. Mm-hmm. And it is so rare for me to not be able to distinguish between, like, somebody sounding, it being a person, and then somebody sounding like somebody else.
Yeah.
It's like, I can tell you when it's an Elvis impersonator as opposed to an Elvis recording, because I've got a trained ear and I know how to spot that stuff. Like, the Paul McCartney that sings on Hard Day's Night is the exact same Paul McCartney that sings in Wings. It's just that simple. Conspiracy over.
All right, then. I mean, none of, like, the complications that I pointed out, but your ear, okay. Yeah. All right. Hey, you know what? Janis Joplin was really busy in 1970.
That she was.
So let's do yours first, because that happened earlier in the day.
Yes, that happened earlier in the day. In 1970, Janis Joplin bought a headstone for the grave of her greatest influence, Bessie Smith. Now, if you haven't listened to Bessie Smith, I suggest you get on YouTube right now and go check her out. She's amazing. Bought a headstone for her greatest influence, Bessie Smith, at the Mount Lawn Cemetery in Philadelphia. The blues singer Smith died in 1937 after being refused admission to a whites-only hospital.
Mm.
Racism kills. That's it all does. I'm saying. So, yes, Janis Joplin did something incredible for her biggest influence. I mean, I would, if I had the money and the fame to do so, I would probably do the same thing if my major influence died as well. So,
yeah.
But
anyhow, so
as far as I know, my dad and Jamie Wolford are still alive, so I'm good.
Hey, Jamie Wolford.
Hey, I'm going to see him in 2 weeks, man.
Are you really? Where?
He's playing in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
The Stereo with Rory.
Really? With Rory?
With Rory. Oh, my.
Did you tell me about this before?
Maybe. You want to go?
I mean, yes.
All right, we're going. It's on a Saturday. We can drive up that afternoon.
Yeah. Done.
Come back on Sunday morning or something.
Done. All right. So later in that day, Janis Joplin. Right.
Yes.
And if I now there were like three different narratives for this story. So if anyone knows details that are definitely facts that I left out of this, feel free to leave them in, because I just wrote down what everyone kind of agreed on that happened, because that's how legends are. Right. There's always like four different versions of the story. Anyhow. So later that day, Janis Joplin had a pre-show drink at a bar named Vossen's in Port Chester, New York. Where she, with poet Bob Neuwirth, wrote the lyrics for the song Mercedes-Benz during a poetry jam. The lyrics were written down on napkins, and she sang it that night later on stage at a concert at Capitol Theater. Of course, on August 12th, a few days later, Janis would play what would be her last show in Boston, and I don't know what happened to those napkins. But I do know that was probably the last time that a poetry jam was cool. Was when Janis Joplin was there. Straight from the Beatniks in the 50s, jumps the pond over to the UK, and then ends with Janis. Never been cool since, anyway.
The only time it was mildly cool was when it was being done in parody by Mike Myers in So I Married an Axe Murderer. Woman.
Man, I don't know. Even
woman.
Then. Even then, man, it's
woman.
Pretty.
Man. She was a thief.
All right.
Oh, man. All right, so let's see here. We got 1992. Metallica opens for Guns N' Roses in Montreal. It has since become a legendary night. James Hetfield is badly burned by pyrotechnics, and Metallica band members personally escort him to the hospital. Meanwhile, Guns N' Roses are rushed on stage to perform, and 15 minutes into the set, quit as Axl complains about his voice.
And predictably, a riot ensues.
As we all know. And actually, this week we will be posting a concert review for what happened a bit ago with Guns N' Roses in St. Louis, because Guns N' Roses hasn't been in St. Louis since the 1991 riot. And it is a well-known event in St. Louis history. And in fact, if you ask anyone, they were there.
I mean, like anyone that's old enough is like, yeah, I was there.
Yes.
I picked up a plant and I threw it into the river. That's always.
Even though they weren't. Apparently, everyone and their mother was at that concert. So a couple million people showed up for that show.
Riverport seats like 20,000 now, didn't it?
It still seats a lot. So.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure before it was like 25,000.
Well, I mean, if you pack the lawn, it's you can get it pretty full.
Anyway.
Speaking of the whole Riverport thing, if you're wondering where our good pal Greg Harvey is, that is where he is at tonight with his girlfriend, Bree, who has also been on the show. They went to a show. She picked him up some tickets. I'm assuming as a birthday present or something, because it was his birthday, just a couple days ago on August 5th. We had a conversation about it earlier this week, so... But yes. So it's kind of a crazy thing with Metallica. I mean, that's kind of a messed up night anyway.
Yeah.
Like James burning, Axl quitting, and then...
Honestly, like all of Guns N' Roses quit kind of at the same time.
That is true.
Like they sort of had like a little powwow, and they're like, yeah, it sounds like shit, let's quit.
So, yeah. That's still just funny. But yeah, if you're wondering, we are going to post a concert review this week. I'm going to do it with a couple of my friends from work who happen to be at the show. So expect that shortly. Let's see here. Moving on to 1996, and to close out August 8th, Kiss appeared at the Riverfront Coliseum in Cincinnati, Ohio, on their 192-date Alive World Tour. During this show, a fan threw his fake leg on stage, which all the members signed and handed back to him.
Because what else do you do when you get just a leg? Hey, guys, a leg.
It's a leg! So, I think that's great. At least they did something super cool and super nice. Weirdly enough, one of the friends who helped me with the concert review, also a huge Kiss fan.
Yes.
Like, seriously, he has Kiss bobbleheads on his desk, and he's going to come and he's going to help us with a Queen review.
Okay. All right.
Because he actually has seen Queen like 5 times now, like just in the last like few weeks, which is kind of amazing. And he just checked him out in Nashville. But he's a huge Kiss fan as well. And so I got to tell him some nice little fact, because he's always making fun of me for being a nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to tell him, hey, did you know that Gene Simmons' costume is based on a comic book character? And he's like, I wouldn't doubt it. And I go, yeah, it's based on a character named Black Bolt. And apparently Gene Simmons is a huge fan of Black Bolt and the Inhumans, and he's super psyched about the new TV show coming out. Because he called Anson Mount, who's playing Black Bolt, and he told him, this is like my favorite character. You know, don't you screw this up, kind of thing. So
yeah.
So there you go.
He had bobbleheads on his desk, but you're a nerd.
Yeah, I know, right?
Right.
Also, okay. he wears hockey jerseys mm-hmm. to work every day, so I told him one day, I was like, he said something about me being a nerd, and I said, me being the nerd, I'm not the one who cosplays to work every day.
Yeah.
So.
Anyhow, hey, August 9th.
Now, right? This
that
is
has a significant. That's
it's
the
a special day.
Day.
It's a special day for mm-hmm. me.
Okay, so I tell you what, take them all.
Because I'll do this. Okay,
just take them all. They're all yours.
All right, so I'm going to start out in 1958. Britain's answer to Elvis, 17-year-old Cliff Richard, signed a record deal with EMI Records. Also on this day, Cliff Richard started a 4-week residency at Butland's Holiday Camp in Clacton on the Sea, Essex. As Cliff Richard and the Drifters.
Towns have very strange names.
They do have very strange names.
In the United Kingdom. Clacton on the Sea.
Clacton on the Sea. And I'm sure that it's probably... That's not Clacton. It's Clacton. Something
right.
crazy. Because they like to make things weirdly sounding. But Cliff Richard's... which is funny because, he goes to Butland's Holiday Camp. Which is... He's very well known for the song Summer Holiday.
Yeah.
So, that just cracks me up. Let's move on. 1963, born on this day, Whitney Houston, the singer, of course, who had massive success, number one singles all over the place, starred in The Bodyguard, and had like a massive hit that was originally Dolly Parton's massive hit.
Yes.
And then Whitney Houston took it, and it was hers ever since. Whitney Houston, who, of course, then tragically died February 11th, 2012. It's kind of a sad end to such a talented human being. But I always hoped that she would get her life back in order and make some type of a comeback. But it did not happen. So there is that. Then moving on to 1982, world-renowned podcaster Brian Croc is born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
The world is forever changed. Songs were written about him. And, all in all, greatest day in music mm-hmm. history, Brian Croc, 1982. Not to be confused with the other Brian Croc, who is the more talented Brian Croc, who plays all sorts of instruments. And actually, he's got this great musical thing that he's doing right now in New York. And I'm totally looking forward to checking it out, where he's got like this big band and everything. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to love it. I'm not joking. That is legitimately someone else named Brian Croc who I've met.
Yes.
So let's see. Moving on up. If you want to get into weird names for British places... 1986, Queen ended their Magic European tour in Knebworth Park in Stevenage, England. First Knebworth, then Stevenage. Stevenage. I don't know. Who cares? It's England. Let's see. With over 120,000 fans witnessing what would be Queen's last ever live performance with Freddie Mercury. On this, their final tour, Queen played to legions of established fans, plus many new ones gained as a result of their show-stealing performance at Live Aid, which was amazing, and yes. It's honestly one of the greatest live performances ever recorded. The support acts for the show were Belluies, I don't know how to say that one, Big Country and Status Quo. And the last songs they played were We Will Rock You into We Are the Champions with God Save the Queen as an encore.
There you go. Yeah, that Live Aid performance, man. Like, anytime... Okay, I know this sounds... This is a weird statement, but, like, anytime you see someone as a Freddie Mercury impersonator or somebody is Freddie Mercury for Halloween, it's always the white pants with the white muscle shirt. You know, from the Live Aid performance.
Occasionally they'll do the yellow jacket, you know, because that was part of it too. But it was still the same white on white with like the jacket. And then, of course, the mic stick, which was always nice.
The mic stick, yeah.
So I ended up watching somebody shared on, I think, a music history thing, like that they did a tribute concert.
Mm-hmm.
And they did Bohemian Rhapsody, but it was sung by Elton John and Axl Rose. And Elton John couldn't sing as high as Freddie Mercury, so whenever it got to the high parts of the song, he would just drop it down an octave and sing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever Axl comes out to sing his part, he was just slightly off key the entire time. I didn't get it, but, you know, it's still the fans loved it, and Brian May and the rest of Queen were spectacular as usual. I think that, you know, it's still, it was a good fitting tribute. Mm-hmm. Elton John's not a bad singer. It's just that he couldn't sing like Freddie.
Oh, he can't really sing like Elton John anymore.
Yeah, he can't sing like Elton John either. But let's see, moving on up to 1995 and to close out August 9th, Jerry Garcia, guitarist and singer for the Grateful Dead, died from a heart attack at the Serenity Knowles Rehabilitation Clinic in San Francisco at the age of 53. Garcia co-founded the New Riders and the Purple Sage and released several solo albums. He is well known for his distinctive guitar playing and was ranked 13th in Rolling Stone's 100 Greatest Guitarist of All Time.
Which I don't understand.
I get it, because I've listened to a couple of Grateful Dead albums over the last year and a half or so. And he actually did have a good style to him. I mean, it's not loud. It's not over the top. He didn't use, you know, the distortion or anything like that. But he just had a really good, like, picking style that it was nice. So, but I don't.
So, yes. August 9th, Jerry Garcia dying, Whitney Houston birthday, and Queen's last performance with Freddie Mercury.
Yes.
Not bad.
And I keep trying to think of it, but... Maybe I don't have it on my list of notes, but here, I'm going to search for something real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You go ahead and move on to the next little tidbit.
I will. We're going up to August 10th now. We're going to start in 1909 with another guitar god, Leo Fender, being born in Anaheim, California.
Boom. I dig it.
Yeah.
I never knew he was from California.
Yeah. He was a surfer dude. In fact, I think he tried to have a surf shop that didn't make any money. However, he was making guitars at the time. Now, he wasn't putting in electronics. He was just doing just woodworking the bodies. But they started to outpace what his surf shop was doing. And that's how Fender guitars became Fender guitars. So there you go. Telecaster, Stratocaster, of course, the P and the J bass. Standards and staples of, I think, every band that's kind of ever played. Or at least since electric has happened.
I dig it.
You dig it? Well, I know you're going to dig this. Go 1947,
ahead.
Ian Anderson is born in Grimsby, Lincolnshire, England.
It's Lincolnshire.
Lincolnshire. Now, of course, a lot of people might not recognize his name, but Ian Anderson is the lead singer and flautist of Jethro Tull.
Aqualung.
Do we not have any Jethro Tull fans in the room?
I'm not a huge Jethro Tull fan, but I do know that they won like best heavy metal album or something like
that. In 89 or 87, something like that,
which still is like for heavy metal fans is like the worst thing that's ever happened.
Now, I really like Jethro Tull. Thick as a Brick is like I think one of the best albums ever made, in my opinion. However, Ian Anderson did a sequel to Thick as a Brick, right? Like, it's weird to have sequels to albums, not like a follow-up album, but we're going to do this album again. And he did it not with Jethro Tull. He did it as a solo project, which is odd, and didn't have any of the Jethro Tull band members play on it. And Thick as a Brick is two tracks. It's the A side and the B side of an LP that are, each side is 22 minutes long. Thick as a Brick 2 is separated out into like 13 tracks. So I don't get Thick as a Brick 2. It's kind of a weird, I don't know. I don't like bands trying to redo, like do sequels to things.
I know of some bands that have like done that, but it's normally with like a concept album.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not like Pink Floyd did Dark Side of the Moon 2.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't do something like that.
Right.
But I mean, I've heard some of them where, you know, it starts off with a story and then it just continues like to the next set of stories.
Yeah.
In the next album. But yeah, I can't think of sort of like a direct sequel.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know like fans have been clamoring for Fleetwood Mac.
Rumors 2. That's never going to happen.
And it shouldn't.
No, and that's exactly why Lindsey went from Rumors to Tusk.
Yeah.
Because he was like, I don't want to do Rumors 2. I want to do something different. And so that's the band was like, okay, Lindsey, you do your thing. And he's like, all right, I'm going to go off and do crap. And so he went crazy and then made Tusk, of which not a lot of people liked Tusk, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was a brilliant album. But originally, he wanted it to be like four records, like a just like a super massive album. And the record industry, or record company, was just like, no.
Yeah, nobody's going to shell out for four albums at a time.
No, that's not going to happen, Lindsey. And he's like, why not? You're messing with my artistic genius. If my wife hears this, I'm going to get in trouble. Well. She's going to be like, were you making fun of Lindsey? How dare you?
Anyhow, all right, we talked about this on the show before.
Yes, we have.
We talked about the recording of it.
Yes.
But on August 10th, 1963, Stevie Wonder's Fingertips became...
Part two.
Well, okay, part one and two, but part two.
The sequel!
Right, became the first live recording to hit number one on Billboard.
Nice.
So, I love that track. I love Stevie Wonder. I like his style of harmonica playing, just... It's just a feel good story just for me.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, he hits number one, which made him the youngest person to hit number one on the U.S. charts at the time.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's beaten that yet.
Probably. How old was the drummer for Hanson at the time of Umbop?
Ooh, yeah, but I don't think they would count that.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't think they would count it from just whatever the youngest member of the group was. So.
Oh, well, I mean, the Jackson 5 as well. I don't know how old Michael was when they had their first
number one. Yeah, that's true.
Stevie was 16?
13, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So he was, and he was the incredible Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
Or, you know, just because everybody's like, hey, everybody, he's blind, just like Ray Charles. Like, and he plays keyboard, just like Ray Charles. It's like, what they didn't say was that he played 1,000 other instruments that Ray Charles didn't, just because he could pick it up.
Yeah.
Like, they actually talked about it in one of the things with the Funk Brothers, that, like, basically, he would go and hang out with the other musicians and be like, hey, explain to me how to play this. And the bass player would be like, okay, here you go. Here's a bass guitar. Here you go. Do-do-do-do-do-do. And then he'd, like, match it perfectly. He just had a complete natural ability to pick up instruments just by listening to them. It's an incredible skill. He's like a mutant. Like, he belongs in the X-Men.
Well, he probably does.
Just saying. But, yeah, so what else?
He would not be the lamest X-Men ever.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cypher would. So here we go. 1968, though. Our favorite Welsh singer, right?
Yes.
Tom Jones goes to number one with Delilah.
Yo, Delilah.
So Tom Jones is still just one of those dudes that can crack me up just from from hearing any of his songs.
You know, every time I hear something like some early Tom Jones, not necessarily his Vegas stuff, but the early stuff, I always think like, man, what a shame it was that he didn't get into rock. Because he has such a big voice, and he's like singing these big band numbers like Delilah. Like, that guy should be doing House of the Rising Sun. He should be doing Purple Haze. Anyway.
So, let's see.
Now, I'll take this one.
Yeah, go ahead. You got this one.
All right, 1976. Just to let you know how B.I.G. big Elton John was, on this night, he played the first of a 10-night run at a little venue called Madison Square Gardens. 10 straight nights at Madison Square. That's more than a week of booking the largest venue in New York City at the time.
That is true. Yes. Which is funny because that has been beaten like numerous times since then. But the last one was, the other piano player. Did Piano Man? Everybody knows this. You listen to the show. I suck at names.
I don't want to say it because I want to see you struggle.
Billy Joel.
Thank you.
So Billy Joel like sold out Madison Square Garden for like 23 nights.
Yeah, but like New York
in
has,
a month
has more venues now.
That is true. And but he sold out Madison Square Garden for like a solid month.
That's crazy.
And I mean, I remember. Like even Fleetwood Mac, like when they go back to London and stuff, they do a ton of multi-night shows in the same venues. It's kind of rare for a band to do multi-night shows here in the States, except for in places like, you know, California or New York. But it's a lot easier to do in New York because everybody's so compacted, you know, into a small area. So it's easier to get multi-nights, you know, with different crowds and stuff.
But, yeah.
But I think I remember Fleetwood Mac, like in Chicago, they did two nights like last time.
Yeah. You're not going to sell 10 shows of 30,000 people in St. Louis.
No, that's like, never going to happen.
If you didn't have a single reprieve, that would be every person, 300,000. That'd be every person in St. Louis winning the show. So
it's something like a total of like 2 million people in the St. Louis and the Metro East area. That's including St. Louis County and like all the places on the East side too. Cause the East side has like 500,000 plus. It's just funny, you know. But let's move on. 1985, Canadian singer and guitarist Bryan Adams scores his first U.S. number one hit with the album Reckless. And if you don't know, in Canada, they worship this man. Worship.
Bryan Adams.
I was listening to the radio when I was up there a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And like, I swear to God, every commercial they brought up something about Reckless because he did the Reckless tour like last year, and yet they were like it was something about like it was released at that time, so it must have hit number one now. It's like in August, but it was released then. And they're like, this was the week that Reckless was released, and Canada was never the same, which just was cracking me up.
Yeah. Brian, what's your favorite Canadian thing?
Favorite Canadian thing?
Not crock, Brian.
Oh, sorry.
Canadian bacon.
Okay, not bad.
Poutine.
All food in this group. I'm going to go with hockey, but no, close second is Rush.
See, now, I could easily
poutine,
do that too.
Poutine's a really close third. They're all sort of up there, but hey.
I'm just saying, poutine, like, when I was in Toronto last time, I got it three times, and I'm happy. When I was in Vancouver, I got it four times, and I was happy. If I ever go to Montreal, I'm getting poutine, and I'm going to be happy.
I thought they say poutine in
no, they say the they say poutine. Okay. They don't say poutine. That's the rest of Canada, of which the rest of Canada actually used to make fun of them until they found out that poutine is like the one of the greatest hangover foods.
Yes,
and then it became insanely popular. But Smokes Poutinery up there, they make some amazing poutine. If you get a chance, check them out.
If you're looking for a good poutine in St. Louis, I'm going to recommend you go down to the Grove and you check out...
Is it Urban Chestnut?
Urban Chestnut.
Yeah. I've actually never been there to try their poutine, though.
It's the poutine of the moment, not even of the day.
Oh,
so
nice.
So it's kind of just whatever they send out of the kitchen, but it's always tasty. This next one.
Brian, you ever had poutine? You're missing out, man. Here in St. Louis, we have what's called a slinger, which is like...
Yeah, I know.
Which is you know, usually fries or potatoes, and then like, you know, some type of meat, usually eggs, and then chili. But over in on the east side, you know, in like Springfield and all of that, they've got the horseshoe, which is fries, some type of meat, and then cheese sauce. Well, poutine is fries, cheese curds, and super hot gravy.
Which doesn't sound like it's going to be all that amazing.
But it is. It's like one of the most savory dishes ever. Mm-hmm. All right, so this next one, 1987.
Yes, now hang on. This is the weird story of the week.
Okay, all right.
All right, and I want you to read it. I'm not going to read it because I want to see if you pick out the same things I did in this story, and if you can like get, I don't think you're going to get through it without laughing at.
Okay.
Because it's ridiculous.
All right, let's see here. 1987, Wilson Pickett, the singer that gave us In the Midnight Hour, Land of a Thousand Dancers, and Mustang Sally, was found guilty in a very confusing trial for knowingly transporting a loaded firearm in the state of New Jersey. That's illegal?
Yes.
After Pickett drunkenly parked his car on the sidewalk of a bar, waved a shotgun around at a crowd, and demanded that a certain mother blanker come out and fight him, what we know witnesses and Pickett himself testified that on July 16th, 1984, he got into an altercation and an argument at a bar with an unnamed patron. Then, according to Pickett, he later returned to the same bar the same night with a loaded shotgun because a friend needed a ride. Then, thinking it was unloaded, he took his shotgun with him for protection that his girlfriend, Jean Cousseau, had loaded it without his knowledge, that he accidentally drove his 1974 Silver Stutz Blackhawk on the sidewalk of the Oval Bar because he lost control from being tired, not drunk, and that bar patron had misconstrued what he said. He was found guilty and given 2 years probation and a $1,000 fine, considering that the charge held a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. I think his lawyer, Walter D. Neely, did okay. What did I just read?
Okay, so yes, so in the state of New Jersey, at the time and now, it is illegal to transport a loaded firearm, right?
Weird.
You can own a firearm. You can hunt with it. You can use it for target practice. If you're in a rural enough area, you can dispatch varmint or livestock with it, right? However, taking it to the range or to anything that you're going to do, including on your own farm loaded, is illegal and carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. Right. So, now, obviously, Wilson Pickett decided that he wasn't done arguing with someone at a bar and drove back there with a shotgun to call him outside. However, in the court, he argued that a friend needed a ride back to the bar, that he had taken a shotgun that he thought was unloaded with him just in case. Because that's how you take a gun to shoot someone is unloaded, right? I always leave it unloaded. I don't need to check it. I'll take this with me just in case I need an unloaded gun. Then didn't drunkenly park the car on the sidewalk outside the front door of the bar, but did that because he was sleepy. And that everyone out there who heard him yell, "Come on, motherfucker!" just misconstrued what he was talking about. And he obviously wanted to buy a newspaper. He was not calling someone out to fight, right? I mean, obviously he wanted a newspaper.
He was just misheard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just saying. Okay. That is still just a messed up story, yeah, either way.
If you want to know, that was 2 hours of reading right there.
Wow.
Right. Thank you, New Jersey newspapers, for putting all of your articles online, because I read every single one that mentioned Wilson Pickett.
Nice. All right. I'm going to move on to something that took me all of 10 seconds to read and then copy over. In 2002, Lisa Marie Presley married none other than actor Nicolas Cage at a resort in Hawaii. The marriage was Presley's third, and she was married previously to musician Danny Coath and pop star Michael Jackson. Cage filed for divorce 4 months later.
Mm-hmm.
That girl cannot catch a break. Just marrying all the wrong sorts of dudes. I don't know what was messed up with this Danny dude, but he had to have been crazy.
Just based solely on her other two husbands?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
It's Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on to our last day, August 11th. What do we got here, Jake?
All right. 1956. A single with quite possibly the very first sample is released. It's called The Flying Saucer. It's by Buchanan and Goodman and eventually peaked at number three. But it's noticeable for sampling bits from other 1956 hits like Earth Angel. The song is basically constructed of like this novelty act of, hey, there's aliens, and radio broadcasts keep getting interrupted.
Mm. Right?
So Bull Buchanan and Richard Goodman used a dub technique that they called break-ins and expressed that they that what they do will most likely never like break out of the novelty genre. However, of course, we know that that's not true. Sampling's a huge thing and has been ever since Curtis Blow released his self-titled album. And there you go. I mean, so unlike today's samples, there were in the 90s, there were huge legal battles over everything. This didn't, like, they used all what the studio owned. And the studio, of course, owned everything that they released. So it was really easy for them to just sample every hit that came out from that record label.
Nice.
You are you a Curtis Blow fan, Brian?
I am a Curtis Blow fan, yes.
You are? Okay, then. So you know the Curtis Blow huge hit Basketball, right?
Yeah, totally.
You don't know it, do you?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Never heard the... Basketball. We're playing basketball.
Now that you sing it, yes, I do know that. Yeah. Let's move on to something I actually do know. 1956, the same day, Elvis Presley releases his double-sided hit Don't Be Cruel and Hound Dog. The single went on to be number one on the U.S. charts, where it stayed for 11 weeks, a record that would not be broken until 1992's Boyz II Men hit End of the Road.
Really?
Yeah.
1992.
Yeah. It's funny, huh?
I mean, I guess, but then again, like, the Beatles were releasing songs, like, every, like, 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
So...
I mean, like, I was reading one of these things, and it was like, you know, top four hits in the UK at this time were the Beatles. It's like, all from the Hard Day's Night soundtrack. Right. Like, oh, okay, that makes some sense. But let's see, moving on to 1962. Here we go,
yes.
Neil Sedaka.
All right.
Neil Sedaka started a two-week run at number one in the U.S. singles chart with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. I don't know. I just wanted to sing that line.
Oh, fair enough.
It's like it was his first U.S. number one as an artist, and it reached number seven on the U.K. charts. But the reason why I like it, because I've always been a fan of Neil Sedaka. Mm-hmm. He's just a weird dude, but he writes some catchy songs.
Well, and also his name is fun to say.
Neil Sedaka.
Sedaka.
So, yep. But let's see.
Also on this day in 1962, Tony Bennett releases a single, Once Upon a Time. However... it contained a very well-known B-side. You might have heard of it. It's only Tony Bennett's most famous song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
That is true.
Which begins the question, and this is why I put this in here, of what is the best B-side of all time? Ooh. Now, you're not going to have anything for like the last 17 years because singles are not a thing anymore.
I don't know, but I know of another one that was like a B-side was Knock Three Times. Three times on the ceiling if you want me. Twice on the pipes, ding, ding. Yeah, that one.
You know what the A-side was?
I have no idea. I don't remember. I remember that one. I think with the Monkees was Sleepy Jean, I think, was a B-side.
Okay.
And when they recorded it, they had like no clue that it was going to be the insane hit that it was.
Yeah.
Man, I'm trying to think of some of the other like famous B-sides, but they're not popping up in my head. I'm sure I can search very easily for a list.
So Don't Be Cruel was a B-side on Hound Dog.
Yeah.
Which Don't Be Cruel, probably the better song, but Hound Dog at the time was more popular.
That is true.
So there's a lot of those. Like, Pearl Jam's Jeremy with Yellow Ledbetter is a B-side. Again, B-side's probably better than the first one. Queen's like We Will Rock You was a B-side on We Are the Champions.
Here we go. I found a decent list of B-sides that were released.
All right.
God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, which is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Oh, yeah.
Silver Springs by Fleetwood Mac. I Am the Walrus by the Beatles.
Wait, wasn't Silver Springs the A-side?
No, it says B-side. Oh, okay. B-side was Go Your Own Way.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Let's see. I Am the Walrus by the Beatles was there. The B-side was Hello Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I kind of got this wrong. All right. So the B side to God Only Knows was Wouldn't It Be Nice, which is a great song. Let's see. The B side to I Am the Walrus was Hello Goodbye. Mm-hmm. The B side to We Will Rock You was We Are the Champions.
Okay, I got it backwards, but
I don't even know that one. But here we go. I mean, this one might actually be a good one for you, Jake.
Okay.
Of course, one of the best B sides. This isn't the B-side, actually, but this is the A-side. The B-side happened to be Behave Yourself.
Okay.
But the A-side was this. My opinion still is one of the greatest instrumental tracks ever made.
Booker T and the MGs.
Ah, such a good song. Green Onions. Of course, that was the side A. Now, if you want, I can play for you the side B.
See, I think we got this backwards. I'm pretty sure Green Onions was the B side. And then it was later used as the title track for the album, but maybe I'm mistaken.
Well, hold on. Maybe I did completely misread the list. Because it's now saying that the B-side to that was Green Onions.
Yeah.
The A-side was Behave Yourself, which is this. It's a great slow blues.
This particular song, I think, has been copied several times.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it has, actually. So let's move on to a couple of other B-sides, though, that we got. We have B-side to Hung on You by the Righteous Brothers. The B-side was Unchained Melody.
Unchained Melody. Their iconic song, right?
Let's see. B-side to Baby Please Don't Go, Gloria by Van Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
The Hound Dog was the B-side to Don't Be Cruel. And yeah, I actually, messed up here. It's like, of course, the Silver Springs was the B-side to Go Your Own Way.
Oh, okay. All right.
And God Only Knows was the B-side to Wouldn't It Be Nice.
Now, I could be wrong about this, but I think Purple Haze from Jimi Hendrix was a B-side, and it was not the single.
I don't know what to tell you about that.
But either way.
I mean, there's so many good ones out here because I'm looking at more lists. It's like U2's The Sweetest Thing. Let's see, 51st Anniversary for Jimi Hendrix. Yellow Ledbetter for Pearl Jam.
Mm-hmm.
Murder by the Numbers for the Police. Carry Me Home, AC/DC. Shut Out the Light, Bruce Springsteen. Total Eclipse, Iron Maiden. Yeah, man, it's just too many good ones there for B-sides that were released that became huge, massive hits. So, but where are we as far as the date goes? Because I got to insert one here.
So we just did
1962.
Yes, Tony
So,
Bennett.
Okay, 1969, and then I've got one that I inserted after the fact, after I sent the notes. So,
fair enough.
So let's see here. Go ahead and do this one, actually.
All right. 1969, Diana Ross herself holds a party at the Beverly Hills Daisy Club, which is not anything new. She did that a lot.
Yes. Right?
She's a good partier, that Diana Ross. Anyhow, this time, her special guest, musical group, the Jackson Five. You might have heard of them. Now, Gladys Knight had previously introduced Motown's head, Berry Gordy, to the Jackson Five, but it was this show, and then later that night, the Jackson Five played for the first Miss Black America pageant, and those two things combined, a Diana Ross party and playing at a beauty pageant, was what skyrocketed the popularity of the Jackson Five.
Well, there you go. I mean, it just happens to be those two events.
Yes. I mean, everyone's like, hey, how do you make it in Hollywood, or how do you do this? Well,
play a party at Diana Ross's.
You play a party at Diana Ross's.
And a beauty pageant.
And a beauty pageant later that night. Or you could also say, just treat your children like slaves and you'll become famous.
So, well, let's move on here.
Okay, insert.
Okay, so this is the one that I inserted. Couple years before 1986, mm-hmm. when Queen played at Nebworth.
Yes.
Another band played at Nebworth in 1979. And it would be their last time playing together in the UK. That band was Led Zeppelin.
Really?
So Nebworth, the cursed grounds. Of Nebworth, of which actually it's the Nebworth House is where they played. Mm-hmm. But it's the set that they did play, however, included The Song Remains the Same, Celebration Day, Black Dog, Nobody's Fault But Mine, Over the Hills and Far Away, Misty Mountain Hop, Since I've Been Loving You, No Quarter, Hot Dog, The Rain Song, White Summer, Black Mountainside, Cashmere, Trampled Underfoot, Sick Again, Achilles' Last Stand, In the Evening, Stairway to Heaven, Rock and Roll, Whole Lot of Love, and Communication Breakdown. And then they never played together in the UK again. That's not true. They've played together many times after that. But this was listed as like their final show after, I believe shortly after John died. And so, you know, it was bad time all around.
Mm-hmm. But I'm checking to see if there's like a Viking burial ground in Nebworth that explains why bands play their last shows there.
I don't know, but I did think it was funny that they were so close together in August as well. So there must be some type of thing in Nebworth where it's like in August they do like some type of...
Yeah, there's like a guaranteed week where there's no rain or something. You know?
Could be. You want me to do the next one?
Go for it. Yeah.
All right. 1980, Johnny Cash goes on The Muppet Show and sings Jackson as a duet with Miss Piggy. This is possibly the only time something has been cute and subversive at the same time.
I love The Muppet Show.
Yes.
Right. The original Muppet Show. When they tried to bring it back just a few years ago.
Yeah.
It didn't have the same subversiveness. There you go. It didn't have the same edge to it.
Yeah.
I always felt like when I was watching reruns, because I was watching reruns at the time. I wasn't old enough to see them live. It just felt like they were getting away with something.
Yeah.
Like they weren't supposed to be doing it. And that's what I loved about it.
Makes sense. Let's see here. 1986. The Monkees go on a reunion tour, and on this day, they have 6 albums chart on Billboard, although it is 200 deep.
Yes, because, you know, the Billboard top album sales is 200 and not the Hot 100 or whatever.
Yes.
But still, like, in 1980, to come back and have basically all of your albums chart is kind of a thing.
That actually just happened with Linkin Park.
Yeah.
Because of Chester killing himself, but it's still... It's interesting because every time somebody either dies or something happens to pop back up again, like all these massive sales come back and then they get back on the charts again. So
I had the privilege of meeting Linkin Park's front of house sound engineer a few years ago. They call him Pooch, but his real name is Ken Von Druten, I think is how you say his name.
Huh.
So it was pretty cool meeting the guy.
Is he a grizzled vet of the touring industry?
Oh, yeah, he I don't know his age, but he's very experienced. He worked with Kiss, who we talked about earlier in this podcast, before working with Linkin Park. So, yeah, I met him a few years ago. It was pretty good.
You know, that's a weird thing about the music industry, that there's these roadies and touring groups that put together shows for bands. And there's not a whole lot of, like, there's some press coverage on it, you know? Like, Rolling Stones might put out a thing, hey, here's this, you know, 80-year-old guy who's still the front-of-house engineer for some band or something. But they don't get written about the same way that, you know, recording studios and producers get written about.
That is true.
Yeah. Like, Mick Hughes, he's been in it a long time, you know, the front-of-house engineer for Metallica. And, you know, if you're in audio, you know who he is. Mm-hmm. But if you don't do audio, a lot of people don't know of him, which I think is a darn shame.
Yeah.
Running live sound is an art form.
Oh, absolutely.
They absolutely are just as important as the band on stage, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Which is why, you know, we yell at the sound guy a lot.
And it's really math heavy, too.
Yes.
Because, like, if you don't know this, listeners, electricity has a speed at which it travels.
Yep.
And it has a speed at which it travels through resistance in wire. And if you have a arena or an outside festival that's big enough, you have to time a delay with every succession of, what's the word I'm looking for? Relays. Like, every relay you hit, every time you hit another set of speakers, you have to time your front speakers
time
back.
Align that to
right.
To
yeah, you have to delay it. So it's really math heavy, and there's math geeks that do this professionally, and they're really good at it. And there's never, even like the Roadies movie that tried to paint everything as like a drunken party, you know, flopped. And
the TV show?
No, there was a movie called Roadies.
Oh, there's a TV show called Roadies.
No,
as
there
well.
Was a movie called Roadies, and I think it had Meatloaf in it.
Oh, yeah.
It did. Meatloaf was a roadie from Texas that was a truck driver that quit to follow his dream, which was being a roadie. Really bad movie.
Hmm.
Anyhow, I think it was Meatloaf.
Well, okay, so there's another TV show that was called Roadies.
Yes.
And it was made by, let's see, the guy who did that one big music movie a few years ago about the kid who travels with the band and everything.
Almost Famous?
Almost Famous, yeah. So he did Almost Famous, and he did the show Roadies. And it's basically just a similar kind of thing of, like, these people who really talk about the power of music and how it influences people and stuff like that. But there were a lot of great cameos on that TV show, as far as I know, which was, they had like the Head and the Heart, Lindsey Buckingham, like Halsey was apparently on the show. Like, it was supposed to be something kind of cool. It did not get picked up for another season, though.
Yeah, so. Cameron Crowe was the director.
Cameron Crowe, that's
who
right.
We just found out 2 weeks ago was married to Nancy Wilson from Heart.
That is true.
Anyhow.
Yes,
small world.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's get to our next one. Hey,
go for it.
1992, the America's Darling, the Mall of America, opens in Bloomington, Minnesota, and Ray Charles sings America the Beautiful because sometimes pop doesn't suck.
I don't get the reference.
There is no reference. I'm just saying that Ray Charles singing America the Beautiful is it's good. It's like good music.
I mean, that's obvious. I mean, Ray Charles could sing practically anything and it would sound awesome. But, I mean, it does, you know, when he sings America the Beautiful, hits me right in the feels.
Really?
So, yeah.
I just appreciate his voice.
I'm just saying.
Anyhow.
But, I mean, especially even when he sings Georgia on My Mind. That's just a great song, too.
Look, my point is that in a moment of sheer commercialism, a mall opening, like, this little window opened up of artistry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know what I still think is hilarious?
Yes.
Is that back when people are still just trying to get started and stuff, they do mall tours.
Yeah. Really?
It amazes me. Apparently, like there's video footage of like Justin Bieber doing mall tours. there's footage of Ed Sheeran doing mall tours, and malls aren't even like a really big thing in the UK. Like, just hilarious to me that people still go out and do mall tours.
Well, Ed Sheeran, he plays anything.
That is true.
Like, he still plays clubs.
Yeah. The other funny thing about Ed Sheeran is that there's a lot of footage of him when he was just basically a street busker.
Yeah.
Like, people just kept recording him and posting it online, and then everybody's like, hey, I've got video footage of Ed Sheeran from 5 years ago.
That's great. That's great. Like,
so, I don't know how he did it, but he did it. So, Jessica can't stand him. My wife can't stand Ed Sheeran. She hates him with a passion.
Why?
And I mean, I listen to some of his stuff, and I'm just like, well, it's pop music. I mean, I don't really get it, but then again, I mean, I honestly think that this Castle on the Hill is a brilliant song. It really is. And that's like his last single that he released. But let's move on. 1995.
Yes.
Here we go. Dangerous Minds opens in theaters, and Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise is on the soundtrack. The track became a cultural touchstone in the U.S. and not only gave a hip-hop a new era of sophistication, but put Coolio in a unique position of being an arbiter for peace in the East Coast and West Coast War.
Yeah, Coolio, absolutely the coolest person to ever live, ever.
That is close to being true.
Oh,
okay.
It is so true. It is so
true. The most interesting man in the world.
He is, man. He's so cool. And Gangsta Paradise was like, it was a great song. It was a great song for the time.
That is true.
You know, and there were even in the record industry, there were people that were still looking down on like hip hop as being somehow like a ham-shackled attempt at music. And but like,
didn't Gangster's Paradise sample Stevie Wonder?
Yes. Yeah, there were several samples on there. Stevie Wonder from Songs in the Key of Life. I can't remember what song now, but
I'm sure I can find it.
Yes,
real
you
quick.
Can. You can go to the website, sampled this or sampled what or that sampled. One of those. But yeah, Coolio, I can't say enough about the guy. Like, from his cooking show to his ability to absorb hot sauce to pulling off haircuts that nobody else in their right mind would attempt.
So it was the chorus and instrumentation of Stevie Wonder's 1976 song Pastime Paradise.
There, yes, that's right.
So, yeah.
Well, not in the title there, too. But hey, you know, when everybody else was writing music about like how tough they were in the gangs that they were in, like Coolio comes in with Gangster's Paradise and paints this sort of like dystopic picture of how hard it is and why you're doing it just to survive. And it really kind of signaled the end of that kind of era of rap and ushered in people like, you know, in the early 2000s, like Jay-Z and Nelly.
Mm-hmm. Easy.
Opening doors for people, because that's just what happens when Coolio's around, man.
That is true.
Doors get open. Anyhow,
that is true.
That's all we got, I think.
Yeah, yep. That's it for our entire list of music history facts. We hope that you have enjoyed listening to this, because I always have fun doing this show. But if you want to listen to some other great programs, of course, you can go to linemedia.fm and find anything that you could possibly want, because there's shows all over the place. If you want to help out the show, you can go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side, do all of your shopping. We get a little bit of money. Doesn't cost you anything extra. Or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. So I am your host, Brian Kroc. And of course, along with me has been Brian Doherty. Say something, Brian.
Yo. Hey, goodbye, everybody.
And my beloved co-host, Jacob Crum.
We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. But you don't have to let the fire go out. I'll follow the sound out of the worm go with this because the internet's forever. Here we go. Thanks.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.